Part of the larger Sioux tribe, the Lakota are one of the oldest tribes of Native Americans who, for much of their history, lived a nomadic life, roaming lands which now carry the names of North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Montana, Wyoming, and Minnesota. Using hunting skills passed down from generation to generation, they lived off the land and, in particular, off the herds of buffalo that existed in abundance on the plains. As befitting a nomadic people, they were also keen navigators, perfecting astro-navigation to help guide them between known hunting grounds. It is believed that the tribe's origins can be found near Mississippi, and that they emigrated to Ohio before moving on to more northern lands. They valued principles of generosity, wisdom, and respect for all life, and considered it the height of success to force an enemy to submit to their superiority without having to fight. The Lakota also had a deep respect for nature and a strong belief in maintaining a degree of harmony between themselves and the animals, other humans, rivers, rocks, and plants, all of whom, in Lakota belief, have spirits and afterlives. As with much of the Native American population, the arrival of white settlers from Europe had a dramatic impact on the Lakota. For one thing, it introduced them to the horse, which significantly changed how the Lakota did almost everything concerning their lifestyle. It made them far more capable when it came to hunting buffalo, and the new skill of firing arrows from a fast-moving horse would eventually be put to good use as the relationship between them and the strangers from over the seas began to sour. But it wasn't just horses that white Europeans brought to North America. Smallpox savaged the Lakota like it did many tribes, the native peoples having no built-up immunity against the disease. Accusations persist to this day that the spreading of smallpox was encouraged by the settlers as a way of eradicating the native peoples and freeing up their land for further settlements, this being achieved by the passing of blankets carrying the disease to the native tribes under the guise of friendship. By the 19th century, the Lakota had migrated again, this time to the Black Hills on the South Dakota and Wyoming border. However, the settlers weren't far behind. There are multiple accounts of meetings between the settlers and Lakota in the early 19th century, including from members of the Lewis and Clark expedition. The Lakota were described as being fairly friendly compared to other tribes, but steadfast in their resolution that their land and their way of life would be defended. This mattered little to the US government, and in the years that followed, more and more passages were made through the lands settled by the Lakota and others, leading to the establishment of the Oregon Trail. This was a 2,170-mile east-to-west large-wheeled wagon route that connected the Missouri River to the valleys in Oregon. Construction of the trail began in 1811, primarily by fur trappers who wished to hunt the fertile grounds. But over time, it expanded to allow passage for settlers looking to make their fortune on the burgeoning west coast of the United States, and in particular, the search for gold. Conflict inevitably broke out between the native peoples and the newcomers. In 1823, the Arikara found themselves at war with the settlers, who continued to violate their territorial borders. Despite having the advantage of local knowledge, the U.S. Army force raised against them had a number of Sioux warriors, including Lakota, to support them against the Arikara, who were eventually defeated. However, this cooperation between the tribes and the U.S. was intermittent at best, for the federal government always prioritized its own citizens when it came to exploiting the land. Indeed, the Arikara War set about calls in the eastern states for the U.S. Army to fully subjugate the native peoples, allowing settlers to dominate the land without opposition. By the middle of the century, the tribes of the Black Hills, including the Lakota, were constantly having to defend their borders and interests, and several banded together for cumulative defense, much to the alarm of the U.S. Army leadership. With ever greater numbers of white traffic passing through the region, the chances of open warfare continued to rise. Therefore, in 1851, the US government sought to convene a meeting with the tribal chiefs in an effort to outline safe zones for the migrants, but this, of course, meant recognizing certain territory as belonging to the Native Americans. While the subsequent treaty was known as the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie, the actual signing was undertaken some 30 miles from the place that holds its name, at the mouth of Horse Creek. The treaty heavily favored the Lakota and their claim to the Black Hills, much to the dismay of other local Native American tribes, who viewed the Lakota as outsiders without an ancestral claim to the land. While the treaty may have initially secured safe passage for the migrants, it thus caused conflict for the tribes, but ultimately it mattered little, for within just a few short years, the gold rush at Pike's Peak in nearby Colorado saw a flood of migrants infringing on native lands again. As well as occupying land promised to the tribes, settlers also took to killing buffalo for sport, and as part of an effort to starve them out, the beast vital to the tribe's survival almost being hunted to extinction by the mid-1860s. The tribes protested, but the US government was uninterested. On the contrary, acting officially or on their own volition, US Army troops actually protected the hunters as they entered tribal lands. A mix of traditional hostility, coupled with dwindling resources, also saw a rise in intertribal fighting, only adding to the hardship. In 1862, gold was discovered in Bozeman, Montana. To speed up the journey time from the industrialized East to the new gold reserves, white immigrants began cutting a trail through the Black Hills and through Lakota territory. Lacking any more faith in the treaty, the Lakota, under the leader Red Cloud, began openly attacking the wagon trains violating their lands, although it should be noted that much of the violated land was in fact promised to the Crow tribe, but had recently been conquered by the Lakota during intertribal fighting. In 1866, in order to avoid further bloodshed, the US government began making diplomatic inroads to the Lakota, for them to agree to allow the wagons through unmolested. Red Cloud was open to negotiation, until, that is, he learned that the US Army was already building forts along the trail to Bozeman, and sensing treachery, he elected to fight instead. Remembered now as Red Cloud's War, open hostilities soon began, with sporadic attacks being undertaken by a confederation of Lakota, Cheyenne, and Arapaho warriors against the migrants and US Army outposts, who, following the old adage that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, were supported by Crow warriors looking to reclaim land. One fort under construction was Fort Kearney, and was manned and defended by a small contingent of US troops under the command of Captain William Fetterman, a veteran of the US Civil War, but who had relatively little experience battling Native American warriors. On the morning of December 21st, 1866, Red Cloud gathered a force of Cheyenne and Sioux warriors, whose number included the legendary warrior Crazy Horse, outside of the fort to attack a wood train passing through. Despite his unfamiliarity with frontier conditions and the methods of combat with the tribes, Fetterman responded with a unit numbering 80 men, but in proceeding outward, he ignored standing orders not to venture beyond Lodge Trail Ridge, which would put him and his men out of sight of the fort, and consequently leave them without the fort's support. Detecting a small band of Sioux warriors, Fetterman ordered his force to pursue them. He was unaware that this was part of a well-orchestrated trap being set against him, and by pursuing the warriors, he was lured into an ambush. Fetterman and his 80-man unit found themselves facing down a combined force of some 2,000 Lakota and Cheyenne, and within just 20 minutes, they had been wiped out, their bodies stripped, scalped, and mutilated. It was the worst single defeat suffered by the US Army at the hands of the tribes up to that point. On the side of the US, there appeared little taste for achieving a military solution. War was proving costly, both in terms of lives and the economy, with Red Cloud's forces making excellent use of the local terrain to wage a classic guerrilla-style war and lay siege to US Army forts and migrant settlements along the trail. Peace envoys were thus sent to Red Cloud, Sitting Bull, and the other leaders of the tribes in the region, and together they carved out a new treaty of Fort Laramie in 1868. The treaty brought an end to ongoing conflict over the Bozeman Trail, and saw the dismantling of the forts, but again, created great upheaval for the tribes and their way of life. Among the 17 articles laid out in the treaty, the Native Americans lost a great many rights. Firstly, they again saw their borders redrawn, as the Sioux tribes found themselves now bottled into a federally recognized reservation. As such, the tribes lost their access to their established buffalo hunting grounds as the US pushed for them to adopt a more agricultural way of life. This, it was believed, would prevent competition between them and white settlers. Any land not specified in the treaty was automatically assumed to be US property. However, any US property made surplus to requirements was to be made available to the tribes. The federal government took prime responsibility for dealing with violators of any articles of the treaty, be they represented by Washington or their respective tribes. In short, the treaty largely took away the right of tribes to enforce their own laws in tribal courts. The treaty also made moves to increase Native American assimilation into US culture and dealt with housing, trading, settling disputes, and providing education for Native American children. Given their reduced territory, the tribes increasingly relied on the US government for this aid and the infrastructure needed to survive. Finally, in the eyes of the US Congress, the tribes effectively lost their identities as nations in their own right, since it was unthinkable for separate nations to exist inside the United States. The treaty was understandably heavily criticized by the tribes, who felt that they had been bamboozled into submission and their culture eroded away by legal jargon they didn't fully understand. Again, resentment and hostility in the wake of the signing spilled out into intertribal bloodshed, only now punishments were mostly dished out by US authorities. This new order established for the tribes split many of its own members into two factions. Some had become despondent in their dealings with the white men, believing ultimately prolonged resistance would only lead to destruction. They began to adopt many of the US ways, including wearing European-style clothing, building European-style homes, adopting their laws and morals, and many even converting to Christianity. However, within a year, another faction rose up, determined to combat the efforts to assimilate the Native American peoples. The Ghost Dancers were a cult that formed in the wake of the treaty, who believed that by performing a certain spiritual dance, that the dead would eventually rise up and oust the invaders, restoring the land to how it had been before their arrival. To that end, the cult actually forbade conflict between the tribes and the white settlers who continued flooding westward. The movement largely died out soon after its inception, but very quickly it resurfaced in the late 1870s, as, once again, the US government began ignoring the articles of the treaty. The land given to the tribes in 1868 was deemed too valuable and was gradually etched away, with tribal protests falling on deaf ears. By 1877, the Great Sioux Reservation had shrunk by almost two-thirds, from 60 million acres down to 21.7 million, and this would fall even further in 1887, with the passing of the General Allotment Act, which left them with a measly 12.7 million acres. The environment amongst the tribes was ripe for the return of the Ghost Dancers. Born in 1856, Wovoka was the son of one of the original Ghost Dancers named Tavibo. Wovoka clung to his ancestral claims to the land, but having worked with Christians in his youth, he adopted similar beliefs in God and Jesus. During a solar eclipse on January 1, 1889, he claimed he was sent a vision in which he died and his soul ascended into heaven where he spoke with God. According to Wovoka, in the vision, he was instructed by God to teach a new dance and spread a message that in 1891, God was going to return the land to the way it once was by burying the settlers under 30 feet of soil. He also claimed that God had told him that their dead ancestors would rise from the grave and join them to help reclaim the land. To that end, Wovoka was portrayed amongst the practitioners of the Ghost Dance as an almost messiah-like figure, Jesus Christ born into a Native American body. This belief was only reinforced when Wovoka produced wounds on his hands and feet, akin to the miracle of stigmata, although it is generally agreed upon now that these wounds were self-inflicted. The followers of the Ghost Dance spread far and wide amongst the tribes of North America, in particular amongst the Lakota. Eventually, as a form of protection against the ongoing violence against them perpetuated by the US Army, the practitioners adopted so-called ghost shirts, garments that displayed symbols on them which they believed would protect them from harm. However, these shirts, and the practice at large, was being interpreted in a very different way amongst some US officials. In August of 1890, 39-year-old Daniel F. Royer became the head of the Pine Ridge Agency, which was responsible for the Oglala Band of the Lakota. Royo was serving as a founding member and head trustee of the Methodist Episcopal Church in Alpena and was an advocate of Native American survival through what he termed a cultural exchange. However, upon assuming his post and observing the ghost dancers, he quickly became convinced that they posed a threat to everlasting peace in the territory. He therefore instigated a clampdown on their activities, at first using local law enforcement, and then, on November 18th, he requested support from the U.S. Army. He even forbade Buffalo Bill Cody from recruiting Lakota warriors for his famous Wild West show, as he saw it as contrary to his efforts to civilize the tribe. Those carrying out the dances were perplexed by this sudden crackdown. The dances themselves were not inherently violent, nor did they encourage violence. They were, after all, intended to summon Jesus to earth and save them. Lakota chief Little Wound wrote to Royer through the teacher John M. Sweeney, stating, "Little Wound understands the soldiers are coming on the reservation. What are they coming for? We have done nothing. Our dance is a religious dance, and so we are going to dance until spring. If we find then that Christ does not appear, we will stop, but not in the meantime, troops or no troops. I also understood that I was not to be recognized as a chief any longer. All I have to say is that not you nor the white people made me chief, and you cannot throw me away as you please. But do let me tell you, Dr. Royer, that by them I will be recognized as long as I live." Royer interpreted this as an act of open defiance and hostility towards him and his mission. It was not helped that Sweeney added his own description in the letter that only reinforced Royer's concerns. Describing Little Wound, he added, "He is a very obstinate man of ungovernable temper, and he is carried away with the dance craze, seeming to believe firmly the absurd doctrines which are preached at these dances. The dancers are those that did not sign the Indian Bill, and in fact they seem to always be in some trouble. They are continually finding fault with the agent, the government, and everything pertaining to civilization. It is a positive fact that the Indian dancers are well armed and have plenty of ammunition, and my opinion is that they have been preparing for trouble for some time. Indians who I have talked to have told me that they would all fight if it became necessary, and that they seem to think that the Great Spirit will assist them so that they can easily overcome the white man." Having called for army support, Royer's superiors immediately began demanding updates on what seemed to be a deteriorating situation. Royer sent numerous telegrams and reports regarding the situation, his calm nature being completely overwhelmed by the perceived hostility he was facing, and as such his reports were rather alarmist in tone, resulting in larger numbers of troops being deployed to quash a perceived imminent uprising. One claim was that it was the largest U.S. Army troop deployment since the American Civil War. The Lakota sensed Royer's weakness and would give him the unflattering name of Young Man Afraid of Indians, and this was certainly true. By late November of 1980, he had largely barricaded himself in his office, believing the world around him was conspiring his demise. Royer put together a list of notable dancers and demanded that the army arrest them and clamp down on the practice altogether. Residing near the Standing Rock Agency was perhaps the most famous Lakota in the form of Sitting Bull. A gifted and popular leader, he had led the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne to their most celebrated victory against the U.S. Army, when on June 25, 1876, they destroyed a force of over 300 U.S. troops led by General George A. Custer at the Battle of Little Bighorn. Many of Sitting Bull's followers, who numbered in the region of 250, were practitioners of the Ghost Dance, although he personally was not. Nevertheless, he refused to let the federal government repress them in any way, prompting Major James McLaughlin, the reservation's agent, to order the arrest of Sitting Bull on the charge of permitting the spread of the Ghost Dance. McLaughlin chose to disregard instructions from his commanding officer, Major General Nelson A. Miles, who wanted a peaceful arrest to be carried out, and instead dispatched 43 tribal policemen to Sitting Bull's cabin on December 15th. Sitting Bull was reportedly compliant, but his followers responded angrily to the attempted capture of their leader. A vicious struggle ensued, and in the violence that followed, 9 Lakota were killed, including the highly revered Sitting Bull. The reservation was now a powder keg, as fear and anger in the wake of Sitting Bull's death gripped the Lakota. Oglala Chief Red Cloud met with federal negotiators at Pine Ridge in the hope of preserving Lakota traditions without bloodshed, aiming to appease both the Ghost Dancers and the concerns of those like Roya. Others, however, were not so convinced of a peaceful solution, and thousands of Lakota began relocating to the South Dakota Badlands, where they fortified their positions in anticipation of an assault by the U.S. Army. Leading the Mini-Konju Lakota was Chief Sitanka. Known rather derogatively to the U.S. authorities as Bigfoot, Sitanka had nonetheless become a respected leader of the Lakota, being a courageous warrior, a gifted tactician, and a shrewd negotiator. Following Red Cloud's war, his people had been forced to live on the Cheyenne River Reservation, where they tried to adapt to their new way of life as farmers. It had been a difficult transition, and as food and supplies grew scarce, he allowed many of his people to undertake the Ghost Dance, although he himself, like Sitting Bull, is not known to have engaged in the practice. This was enough to put him on the list of those subject to arrest, however. After Sitting Bull's death, Sitanka decided to have his people travel to Pine Ridge to join Red Cloud. The number of those to make the journey with him had swelled to over 300 men, women, and children, with the arrival of some of Sitting Bull's followers, who had fled from the scene after their leader's death, fearing reprisals at the hands of U.S. soldiers. Wounded Knee Creek is a tributary of the White River, approximately 100 miles long, and takes its name rather literally from the story of a fight between Native American braves, one of whom sustained an injury to his knee during the confrontation. It was near this creek that Sitanka and his people would fatefully make camp in the final days of that bitterly cold December. On December 28th, 1890, advanced scouts of the U.S. Army's 7th Cavalry, under the command of Colonel James W. Forsyth, spotted the camp. The 7th Cavalry was not just another unit of the Army. It had a legacy when it came to its dealings with the Lakota, for it was the 7th Cavalry that had followed General Custer into battle less than 15 years prior, when he made his famous last stand against Sitting Bull. No doubt every soldier within its ranks that December had been ingrained with the story, and were adamant that it would never be allowed to happen again. Just how big a part the history of the 7th Cavalry played in what happened next is open to opinion, but it is certainly something that cannot be ignored in the annals of history. Sitanka was made aware of the scouts, and recognizing his people's vulnerability, he made contact with them and told them to return to Forsyth, promising they would surrender rather than fight. The next day, December 29th, Forsyth met with Sitanka and informed the Mini-Konju chief that as part of the surrender, his men would be confiscating all their weapons. Sitanka was hesitant, but realizing he had little choice, agreed. Forsyth had his men herd the Mini-Konju, including the women and children, into a nearby clearing, where he surrounded them with his cavalry. For fire support, he had also positioned 4 Hotchkiss guns on a hilltop bordering the clearing. His men then began the process of disarming them, but the atmosphere was tense. Forsyth's men were less than subtle, and tempers amongst the Mini-Konju were already flared over the death of Sitting Bull. As part of seizing their weapons, Forsyth's men undertook an intrusive search, which invoked protests from the Lakota, and arguments began to break out. Eventually, a man known to history as Sit Straight decided enough was enough, and adorned himself in his ghost dance garment. He immediately began his dance, hoping it would encourage others, believing that if they did so, they would be protected from the soldiers' bullets. However, the dance only inflamed the situation. The 7th Cavalry continued confiscating weapons as the dance continued. The task was largely complete when a deaf Mini-Konju man named Black Coyote refused to hand over his gun. In the scuffle that followed, the weapon unintentionally discharged, but in the hostile environment, the 7th Cavalry interpreted this as a deliberate attack and began opening fire into the herded and now almost totally defenseless Mini-Konju. Men, women, and children fell to the ground, including Sitanka. In the frenzy that followed, as bullets continued firing into the crowd, a number of Mini-Konju managed to flee the soldiers that surrounded them. However, the operators of the Hotchkiss guns saw them and began firing as they ran. Those who managed to even escape this horror found themselves pursued by soldiers on horseback and cut down without mercy, regardless of age or gender. It was a bloodbath. After the guns fell silent, Forsyth ordered his men to gather up 51 wounded Minikonju and have them taken to the Pine Ridge Agency, while 146 Minikonju were buried in a mass grave, where the Hotchkiss guns had been placed, a location known today as Cemetery Hill. Hearing the tale of what had happened, hundreds of Lakota fled the area in horror, while others decided it was better to stand and fight, the 7th Cavalry themselves being ambushed in retaliation in the days after, although this only encouraged US authorities to send more troops to the area. Modern estimates put the death toll amongst the Minikonju between 250 and 300 killed, nearly half of whom were women and children. In the chaos of the massacre, some 25 members of the 7th Cavalry were killed, most of whom died as a result of gunfire from their own troops occupying positions on the opposite side of the clearing, where their victims were falling. Forsyth attempted to describe the massacre as a battle, but investigations and testimonies of witnesses revealed otherwise, and he was later stripped of his command, only to have it reinstated and his men to receive awards for bravery. It was part of a political spin on the incident, so as not to vilify the 7th Cavalry and to continue the narrative of the militant cult growing amongst the Lakota, known as the Ghost Dancers. 20 members of the 7th Cavalry even received the Congressional Medal of Honor, the highest award for valor in the United States Armed Forces, for their actions. The massacre was the last major confrontation between the US Army and the Native American tribes. Believing that only death would follow if they didn't submit, many chiefs actively encouraged assimilation into the white man's world, the Ghost Dancers disappearing after the failure of Jesus to descend from heaven in 1891. This was no easy task for the tribesmen, however, and many of the generations that followed lived in abject poverty on reservations amongst a culturally divided people still demonized in American culture as savages. Thanks again to War Thunder for sponsoring this episode. Remember to check them out with the link in description and pinned in the comments section below. Formed in July of 1986 by Russell Means, Dennis Banks, and other Native American leaders in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the American Indian Movement, or AIM, was a militant political and civil rights organization initially founded to address systematic issues of poverty, discrimination, and police brutality against Native Americans. Very quickly, however, its focus was expanded to cover historical injustices laid out against Native American tribes, in particular the violations of treaties by the US federal government, as had happened to the Lakota, amongst many others, in the decades leading up to the massacre. The movement very quickly grabbed headlines around the world when it joined other Native American groups in the occupation of the Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary. Alcatraz closed on March 21, 1963, after which local tribes claimed they had a right to the island on which it was built under the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie, which promised land that was surplus to the federal government requirements. The 19-month-long occupation energized the Native American civil rights efforts, and more protests followed. Then, in early 1973, members of the movement decided to forcibly occupy the Wounded Knee site. The area was governed by tribal chairman Richard A. Wilson, and when an effort to remove him from office through legal means failed, on February 27th, some 200 armed Lakota and members of the AIM occupied the town. They accused Wilson of corruption and the intimidation of those who opposed him. In response, US Marshals and FBI agents descended on the town and surrounded it, leading to a 71-day standoff, during which both sides exchanged gunfire, resulting in 2 tribal members being killed, 16 people wounded, and 1 African-American civil rights activist, Ray Robinson, disappearing while meeting with members of the American Indian Movement in the town. The occupation aimed to do more than just raise awareness of the tragedy that took place there in 1890, which many Native Americans felt was being wiped from the official history of the territory. The living conditions for those still living in Pine Ridge was appallingly bad at that time, and the occupation was intended to highlight the wider neglect of the Native American people in the United States. Not only was Wounded Knee labeled as one of the poorest areas in the United States, but life expectancy amongst its population was also far below average. Also, once again, the issue of treaty violations by the US government came up. On May 8th, the AIM surrendered following negotiations with authorities, who publicly pledged to investigate their grievances. Russell Means and Dennis Banks were both arrested, but on September 16, 1973, the charges against them were dismissed by a federal judge on the grounds of the unlawful handling of witnesses and evidence by the federal government. Despite the end of the occupation, violence continued to break out between locals and law enforcement agencies in the area over the following 10 years. The situation was exacerbated by factional violence, and Wilson managed to hold on to power until 1976, when he was defeated in the local election. Over time, the United States has increasingly come to accept the darker chapters of its past. A major victory came in 2017, when several members of the US House of Representatives introduced the Remove the Stain Act, a bill that rescinded the medals awarded to the troops who participated in the Wounded Knee Massacre. This measure being co-sponsored by Rep. Deb Haaland, one of the first American Indian women to serve in Congress. Nevertheless, the battle for equality, representation, and respect of Native American traditions continues on, meaning the wounds of the past are yet to be fully healed.